Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Hello and welcome to another Yale Journal for International Affairs podcast. I'm Alex DeFrond. Today we will be talking to Emma Skye, former political advisor to the US military in Iraq, about the state of Middle East politics, the legacies of Barack Obama's foreign policy, and, inevitably, what comes next under Donald Trump. Stay with us. Today I'm joined in the studio by Will Wright, a first year's master's student at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs. Thanks for being here, Will.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Emma Skye served as advisor to the commanding general of US forces in Iraq from 2007 to 2010, having previously advised NATO in Afghanistan in 2006. Prior to that, Emma Skye worked in the Palestinian territories for a decade. She's the author of The Unraveling, High Hopes and Missed Opportunities in Iraq, and she is now a senior fellow at the Jackson Institute at Yale. Thank you for joining us, Emma Skye.
Thank you.
So we're recording this on the 9th of November, in the afternoon, the day after the United States have elected Donald Trump as the next president. And walking around New Haven today is a slightly strange experience. There's a lot of bleary eyes. There's a lot of people soul searching. There's a lot of people tired and confused and uncertain about what the future holds. And so I think the obvious place to start, given that, is to ask you a question about what you think this means for the US's standing in the world, and what a foreign policy under President Donald Trump might look like.
You know, I think all of us are in that state of shock, numbness, not quite sure of what to make of it, because we manage to live in our own bubbles, in our parallel universes. And, you know, everybody I know in America voted for Clinton. But, a large segment of the population voted for Trump. And there's all this fear. What does that vote actually mean? And the campaign has been so ugly, and people are thinking all the worst cases. And so I think it's important to just not overreact, to stop, to reflect, to try and understand what's happening domestically in the US. Because it's a global phenomenon, this globalization, the speed of change that is coming about, which leaves people feeling left out, left behind, makes them feel that their country is changing beyond recognition. And a lot of the things that supporters of Trump complain about are things which are really evident at Yale. So they complain of political correctness, of all this stuff about safe spaces, microaggressions. And yet at Yale, that is something that is really at the heart of what students care about. And so I have, you know, Muslim students, minority students are all really, really anxious today. What does this mean? And we don't know. Because what somebody says during the campaign doesn't, you know, it can not always be a good guidance for what's to follow. And with Trump, it's very difficult to know what his foreign policy is, because even though he's the Republican Party, he doesn't bring with him the Republican Party apparatus. The establishment doesn't come with him. So many of my friends who are Republicans, who are part of former administration, are not going to be in the new Republican administration. So I could tell you what a Romney foreign policy was. I could tell you what a Clinton foreign policy was. But it's very hard to know what a Trump foreign policy is going to be. There are a few indicators. One is certainly his relationship with Russia. And he wants to have a closer cooperative relationship with Russia, much less antagonistic than the current relationship. So that sends some signals. And you might think, oh, are we going to come together with Russia to work on Syria? He's more likely to be okay about Assad remaining in power. But during the elections, he really spoke out against the Iran deal. Does this mean that he's going to do everything to stop the Iran deal? We don't know. So each country, I mean, you can see Israeli officials saying, oh, Trump is going to be good for us because he's not going to put any pressure for a Palestinian state. But the truth is, we don't know. We don't know who's going to be his Secretary of State, his Secretary of Defense. We don't know what his policies are. Will he be isolationist? Or will he want to engage?
Yeah, I mean, earlier this year, one thing you touched on there, earlier this year you had the 50 Republican national security and foreign policy experts signing a letter denouncing Donald Trump and saying they wouldn't serve under him. Now he's won the election. Do you think that they might reconsider and decide to serve under him?
It's really hard to tell, because there are some people who left the door kind of open. But I don't think Trump really expected to win. I think he was making a point. But so he hasn't got any plans of how to be president. And it's going to be interesting to see whether some Republicans will try and cozy up to him. But I don't know how many mainstream Republicans will be prepared to work for him. I really don't. You've got General Mike Flynn, who has been very pronounced on the campaign that he's likely to have a senior position. But he's not somebody who's even a Republican. He's just followed Trump. So it remains to be seen. But I don't expect the big names to want to work with him. But I also do expect that some people will think this is a great opportunity to come from complete obscurity and to get a big job in this administration.
Yeah, this reminds me of a panel discussion here at Yale about a month ago about the Syrian crisis, on which Robert Ford, the former US ambassador to Syria, was sitting. And he was asked a question by the audience, what would Donald Trump's approach be to the Syria crisis? And Ambassador Ford thought for a moment. He then chuckled and he said, I have no idea, but I know that I'm going to Canada. And the room, of course, laughed. But I wonder now, reflecting on that moment, do you think there was a complacency in the foreign policy and national security establishment? Had they really ever seriously considered the possibility that Trump might be elected? And have they started thinking about some of the ways that they now respond to this moment?
I don't think they'd ever considered that Trump would be elected. It was, you know, reality TV, this election. Now on my Facebook feed, I've been watching what people are writing. And after the initial shock, they say, look, we are civil servants, we are public servants, we serve whoever is in power, and we will do our best for America, because it's about America, it's bigger than any individual. So again, you know, the American system is full of checks and balances. It's very hard to bring about quick radical change. So I think there's going to be a lot of fear-mongering over the next few months. But there'll also be, you know, practical steps taken to try and work out what a foreign policy might look like. And I imagine Trump's advisors will start reaching out to a broader selection to come up with something coherent.
What sort of impact do you think his election will have on Barack Obama's policies, particularly with respect to the assault on Mosul, the advance on Raqqa? Do you think these things will be hastened or paused, or are they going to continue business as usual?
It's funny you should mention Iraq, because, you know, it's the Iraq war that led to the rise of Obama. Without the Iraq war, we wouldn't have ended up with President Obama. And without Obama, we wouldn't have got Trump. Trump is the anti-Obama. He's the antithesis. And Obama's foreign policy was more about focusing on home. Clinton's foreign policy was much more interventionist, much more proactive. Where Trump portrays himself as more isolationist. So is it possible that Trump's foreign policy might not be that different from Obama's in the Middle East? We don't know yet. You know, the Iraqis aren't saying, gosh, we want many more American troops inside Iraq. They're not saying that. The Syrian government is certainly, you know, it hasn't invited the US to be there. Is it possible that Russia and America might reach agreement to go after ISIS together, to cooperate on that? That is possible. Would Trump agree or support Assad remaining in power? That is possible. But that doesn't address the underlying problems in the region that led to the rise of ISIS. So it could crush this iteration of ISIS, but create more grievances for the son of ISIS to arise in a few years.
Do you think the military has learned, or the government establishment as a whole, do you think they've learned any lessons from Iraq War, specifically, you know, the stuff you mentioned in your book and the missed opportunities? Do you think there's any hope for employing some of those longer term solutions, those kind of non-kinetic, more development-oriented tasks? Is there any hope for that in a Trump presidency?
So after the 2003 war, or you could look at the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War and ask, have we learned anything? How have we managed to stay at war for so long, achieve so little, and yet keep going? You know, you'd think we should be asking ourselves, why does the greatest country in the world with the greatest military in the world lose its wars? And it's not just about having, you know, doing more development or more security assistance. It's much more of actually having a strategy, a national strategy. And I don't think we have got better at formulating that strategy, which looks at achieving a political outcome. And how do we use the different instruments of national power to achieve that outcome? So you can think of the Obama administration in Libya. And Obama says, you know, his greatest regret is not having a plan for the day after in Libya. And that's just a few years after the Iraq War when we had no plan for the day after. Now we're going to the Mosul operation. And what comes after the Mosul military operation?
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows. Who's going to be in charge of Mosul? How's it going to be governed? Where are the resources going to come from? How will reconciliation take place? And Raqqa in Syria, what happens after ISIS is defeated there? And will we all be high-fiving, yes, ISIS is defeated, but, you know, that's just this moment. It's not dealing with the bigger strategy. When you look at ISIS or you look at Trump or you look at Brexit, they're symptoms of a bigger problem. And the symptoms of, you know, dysfunctional governance in the world, people feeling that governments and regimes are not doing what they should be doing, and people look to protest. And they protest by supporting Brexit, Trump, ISIS. But dealing with those root causes, trying to create better government, which is inclusive, which provides all citizens with opportunities and treats everybody fairly, we're all struggling to do that, whether in the Middle East, in Europe, or here in America.
What do you think the barriers are to the development of a longer term American strategy? What is there any hope for us to build up those kinds of capacities?
There's not consensus in America on America's role in the world. Is it be, you know, the city on the hill that everybody should admire? Or is it to be the crusader? And we've seen the crusading didn't go too well. And that really, you know, has done huge damage to Americans' reputation in the world, the Iraq War. But the city on the hill, you look at America today and it's like, whoa, this is not the America of the Founding Fathers' vision. Nowadays, you know, democracy is not looking that good. It's not like a model that other countries are going to want to emulate. So it's time for soul searching for all of us. I think out of this crisis, there is the potential to come opportunity. You can sit here weeping, saying, you know, it's the end. Or to think, where do we go from here? How can we build something more positive for everyone? How do we deal with these inequalities? How can we make the world more just? But that's going to take some time to create that new thinking. The old order is being pushed aside. And that old order, which, you know, provided global security since the end of the Second World War, that era has now come to an end. And I think we'll look back and we'll see it was the Iraq War, not 9/11 itself, but the way we responded to 9/11 that brought that old order to an end.
This question of what this new world order might look like is something that Trump actually has an answer for. It's something that he's been talking about for decades. And he's someone who doesn't believe in this image of America as the world's policeman. He's someone who wants other countries to pay their own way. And he thinks that the American military has been exploited. And he doesn't want the US military, for instance, helping the Europeans against Russia in Eastern Europe. He's also been critical of free trade deals, and he wants, you know, a shift to kind of focusing much more on, you know, Americans' own economic interests. And as I say, this is something he's been talking about with regards to Kuwait, with regards to Saudi Arabia. And then you link that to another trend that you mentioned earlier with his shift towards Russia, and him speaking, you know, him praising various authoritarian figures, even saying that he'd be in favor of, you know, South Korea developing a nuclear arsenal. I wonder whether some of these themes will coalesce into an image of what a new world order would look like and what role America would play in that world order.
Yeah, I mean, it's really possible. It's been easy to criticize the status quo. It's going to be much harder to think of how you build this new world order, because the European Union is melting down. Populist politics, you know, it's not just in America. You see populism across Europe as well. Fear of immigration, fear of stagnant wages, fear of lack of jobs. But stopping trade, putting up barriers, may not prove to be the solution, because it's free trade that has brought America huge prosperity. America hasn't sent its military all around the world out of the goodness of its heart. It's benefited from this. America's benefited more than anyone else from free trade.
Yeah, I wonder whether Trump will have a different view of how the world operates. And his view is rather more transactional. So he'll say that, you know, because NAFTA benefits Mexico, it is in some way not benefiting Americans. And so there's not this sense that everyone can win. Like this idea that free trade can allow everyone to win is a fallacy. And that also expresses itself domestically. You know, the fact that we now have minority groups who are receiving more of a kind of political say, for instance, means that white working class communities are losing some of their power. So this kind of zero-sum game that it seems that Trump has created and some of his followers seem to agree with. And I wonder whether this new kind of view of how the world operates could now be reflected in the way that, for instance, different states negotiate trade deals, how they engage diplomatically when it comes to discussing issues like the Middle East. Do you have a sense of how those conversations might work?
I don't. I really don't, because when you look at the world today, at one level, we're more interconnected than we've ever been. And that provides great opportunity to understand each other, to build empathy, to build trust. But too often we're not using it that way. We're just dealing with people who are like us, who are like-minded. So we put ourselves, you know, we curate the information we receive, we curate the people we interact with. So we're just with like-minded people, where we're not really having that good back and forth argument that leads to better solutions. So I think there are many opportunities here, but it requires those who have lost to engage with those who have won and not try and bring everything down. And it requires those who have won to be gracious and to be willing to engage as well.
You know, from the Western perspective, sometimes it seems like China and Russia have a long-term vision, and it seems much easier for authoritarian regimes that don't have to build a consensus to plan, you know, decades in the future for where they would like to see their country to go. And the way in which Donald Trump appears to, he doesn't seem to be shackled by the need for building a consensus. Do you think there's any chance that he's going to be able to build, he might have a coherent vision for where what America's place in the world can be?
I think he has got a vision. It won't be as articulately laid out as President Obama's vision. But again, America is much bigger than one individual. There are democratic institutions. There are processes. And it can't just be hijacked and overthrown by one person. I mean, you know, it's not long ago when George W. Bush was president. And everybody was like, oh my God. You know, half the country then were thinking this is the worst thing that's ever happened to America. Now this is on just a completely different scale. So America survives. America is resilient and is robust.
If President-elect Trump had a moment of lucidity and he was smart enough to dial up, you know, Dr. Emma Skye at Yale and
I'm
said...
I'm not a doctor.
And said, Professor Skye at Yale, what should I do about governing Mosul once we've managed to clear out ISIL? What do you think are the best aftermath is for Mosul after the, you know, once the majority of the fighting concludes, presumably within the next few months?
Well, I would say, you know, President Trump, Mosul is not yours to govern. Got to get away from that sense that, you know, it is America's to do this or America's to do that. So I would try and help him understand what Mosul is, why Mosul is important, what the complexities are, who the different players are, and what sort of role America might be able to play in helping to coordinate, in helping to guarantee some sort of political settlement. But I would explain to him over and over again that it's about the politics. And we can influence the politics, but we can also make things far worse. So to understand the complexity, but not to think that we own it, that it's, we don't own it. When we owned Iraq, we collapsed the state and brought about civil war. When we owned it, what we did, we brought about the deaths of 200,000 people. So it's not about us owning Mosul. It's about helping to contribute to a political settlement, an Iraqi political settlement. How do we help bring that about? What role can we do? How can we help balance Iran? How can we help bring all the different players in Mosul to the table? How do we nudge people closer towards each other?
So I wanted to shift slightly away from the Middle East and then focus kind of more broadly on some of the issues that the last couple of days have brought to light about foreign policy in the country. So the first was to share an NBC poll that was done in September, which showed that Trump led Clinton amongst military personnel and veterans by about 20 points. And this is despite the statements he made regarding Senator John McCain, his criticisms of the Khan family, the controversies over him not donating money to the vet charities. And as someone who worked on the front line, what do you think the military's attitude to Trump reflects a broader attitude to the direction of US foreign policy? Or are there more kind of broader things at play regarding kind of class and education and geography and things like that?
I think it's some of all of those things. I mean, military people tend to be conservative. So that's just a generalization, but they tend to be conservative. They tend to vote conservatively. But there are a substantial number or percentage who are of minorities who tend to vote democratically. But I think, you know, that's one way of looking, or one way of trying to explain it. Another way is that the military has been at war now since 2001. These are two unwon wars, and people are serving year after year after year. They're killing people, they're watching their friends die, they're losing limbs. And we've run out of narrative of what it's for. You know, up until a certain stage, it was, you know, we're fighting them over there to keep Americans safe here. And that narrative carried out for, you know, a few years, revenging 9/11, keeping Americans safe. But that narrative has run out of steam. It doesn't make any sense, if it ever did make any sense. And so I think when you look, a lot of people, they're not voting for Trump, they're voting against the status quo. It's a protest vote. People have been at war too long. They want to vote out the status quo. They don't know what they're voting for, but they're voting against the status quo. So I think in this election, a lot of people voted against Clinton, or they voted against Trump rather than voting for either. And I think the military vote is best understood as a protest against being at war for so long.
Yeah, I think a linked question, and I know this is something you touch on a little bit in your book about how the fact that you're a woman and British somehow impacted the way that that forces interacted with you on the front line. So what do you think the loss, Hillary Clinton's loss, given that she was consistently polled ahead in terms of foreign policy issues over Donald Trump, what do you think her loss says about the role of women in foreign policy?
It's interesting because I think women over a certain age, and I think they put it women over 50, it really mattered to them to have a woman as president. But for women under 50, it wasn't so important because one of the successes of the feminist revolution is the position of women really has improved. And, you know, people said, oh, Trump can't possibly win because he's so misogynist. He said such outrageous things against women. A lot of women voted for him. So it doesn't necessarily reflect the loss of feminism as such. But when you look at, you know, young black kids, look at Obama and think, one day I could be president. And the same with little girls seeing a woman in power, think, one day I could be president. So I think psychologically, it would have been important. And I hope in the not too distant future that America will have a female president one day. But I don't necessarily see this as, you know, the major setback for women's rights, because that's measured in different ways.
And specifically in the area of foreign policy, do you think your gender ever impacted the way that you were treated? And do you think that women are engaged with in a different way to men in the sector of foreign policy?
You know, I think women can have different instincts. So I think women can, but it's not always, because when you look at Margaret Thatcher, she's got all of those qualities or had all those qualities that you associate with men. But you can argue that women tend to look for negotiated settlements rather than using violence to achieve an outcome. That women could be more concerned about security forces rather than thinking security forces are their natural protector, because too often women feel abused by people in power. So I think there are some different instincts. But again, that really is changing. I mean, I think when I was working with the military, I think my accent had far more influence on people than my gender, because it's just a different voice. It's a different way of speaking that made people think, wow, there are different ways of looking at the world.
Really? Did you have anything?
What do you think, with the military's been downsizing before, up until this point, and, you know, President Obama has appeared to have a little bit of a retreating foreign policy, like you said, more focused on domestic issues. What do you think American, if in the event President Trump attempts to engage more globally as in order to assert American influence, what do you think that looks like, and where do you see him? Do you see him prioritizing a military intervention, or in terms of, you know, instruments of national power, more of an economic or diplomatic or even potentially informational campaign in terms of restoring America's, you know, quote-unquote greatness?
Well, we don't want to have a situation where it's a military in search of a mission. You want a country to have a policy and a country to have a strategy and then think how to achieve that strategy. And I think because there's been this sort of limbo state where it's not sure what America's role in a changing world is, that the military starts to get very anxious because it's trying to cover all eventualities because it's not given any priorities. So the military then spreads itself very thin and can't keep up with modernization, with readiness, because it's trying to cover everything. Now, that's an impossible situation to be in. So we shall see. It's hard to know. You know, if Trump has a bad day, it's really quite hard to know how things are going to go. But you can't just suddenly decide, I'm going to invade. You've got Congress. You've got laws. You've got decisions that things have to be voted on. So, again, we need to wait and see how these things play out. But the initial sense is that Trump looks for a more isolationist role, that he won't be thinking of, you know, how do I use my military here, there, and everywhere? He'll be looking much more at economics and how to keep America rich or make it richer. There
you go. Thank you to Emma Skye for joining us. Thanks also, as always, to Jack Lawrence for our theme music and to Phil Kearney for producing this podcast. In the coming weeks, we'll be talking to Mark Oppenheimer about the future of journalism and to Anne Eller on the history of Caribbean emancipation and citizenship. Keep informed of those by subscribing to this podcast on iTunes. Visit our website at yalejournal.org and follow YJIA on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening. Until then, goodbye.